belief that was installed in you early on. The undeserving child still hides in you and emerges whenever something good comes your way. The fear you feel now can be reconfigured as a call for your attention from the child inside you. Welcome him and hold him, reassuring him that he is not powerless anymore. You will handle his losses and rejoice in his gains. You may say, "The adult I is here for the child me. I know how you still feel those fears, but I am with you now, and I have many resources. You can rely on my protection. I will simply sit with what you, that is, I, feel in a mindful way." This metaphorical active imagination technique ends the child's sense of being undeserving and increases his trust in himself, that is, in yourself. Most of us have internalized many messages by which we judge and insult ourselves. But when we notice a censorious, self-debasing voice within, we do not have to submit to it. We can focus on it as an assault by an inner enemy who is caught in the habit of self-defeat. We can patiently redirect the judgmental voice, converting it to a new, avuncular voice, one with feisty compassion for our frightened inner child, one that speaks kindly to us, one that responds to us with attention, acceptance, appreciation, and affection, and allows for error. This is how we self-soothe and keep from giving up on ourselves. The loving voice of the inner ally accepts us as we are, and we feel stronger and more lovable. What works is patient redirection of the judgmental voice to the new avuncular voice, the voice of the kindly uncle. A new adult driving force is now at work when we work on ourselves in ways like this. Our new inner voice is not a soliloquy. It is being listened to by the enlightened companions of grace who assist us on the path. We are not alone in our practices. Love is all around us. We are all lovable because there is an enduring wholeness in us, our Buddha nature, a capacity to love that remains uncompromised no matter what has happened to us in life. This basic goodness is the core of our being. It does not have to be conjured by effort, but is a grace given to all of us, abiding intrinsically in human nature. We access the gift dimension, grace, when we look with friendliness upon ourselves. Our ego defenses arose in reaction to unfriendliness toward us from others. They thus originated in a frustrated longing for love. That is why our puffy ego deserves compassion, not insult. We can choose compassion for ourselves, be a Buddha to ourselves. The Buddha's first words upon enlightenment, as he looked at the world and the human heart, were, "Wonderful, wonderful." Or we can campaign against ourselves, be a Martin Luther, who nails onto our hearts his 95 theses of what is wrong with us. Imagine yourself a missionary when you hear those critical voices inside. Gently but indefatigably work to convert them to a more compassionate form of spirituality. Then when next they speak, they will be fellow practitioners of mindfulness and loving kindness. Finally, when the desperados of the neurotic ego, fear, grasping, expectation, judgment, control, attachment, threaten our psychic domain, it is time for mindfulness. Sit quietly or walk slowly as you contemplate each stressful assault and let go of it with a label such as, "just a thought," or with an affirmation such as, "I let go of control in this predicament and let the chips fall where they may." Then expand your personal concern into universal loving kindness, mature love. May all beings let go of whatever stands in the way of their happiness. This is how we move from ego love to eco love. Allowing both sides. Read these questions and statements to your partner or to yourself and ask how you can act on them. Will there be losses in my life? I've been there and back. Will there be wonderful gains? I found them before and trust the universe to give them again. It will not be all pleasure or all pain, all hope or all despair. It will be some of each, and and I have it within me to handle the pain and enjoy the pleasure. Was my mother always kind to me? Was my father always tender toward me? No. I found that consistency is rare in human relating, and that has to be okay. With such a history, I will never expect anyone or anything to be perfectly consistent, perfectly pleasing, or perfect at all. My accommodation with the givens of my existence makes me a healthy adult. Could I have come to that accommodation if I had spent all my time only on the bright side of the river? Being aware of fulfillment. In your journal, list specific ways the five basic needs, the five A's, were fulfilled or neglected in your past. Since these five needs are also the central qualities of love and support, list what you have been looking for in your adult relationship and draw lines connecting similar entries on both lists. Are your most desperate needs now in relationship the very ones that went unfulfilled in your childhood? Ask your partner and or children how good you are at receiving and responding to their needs. If you feel brave and clear about yourself, make a careful list of all your unmet needs. Show this list to your partner and say, "Here's what I don't want you to provide, because this is my work." Finding the holes. It is painful for us to find ourselves fully. We avoid the holes that were left in us by the disappointments of early life and adult relationships. But we launch ourselves into them and through them. Here is an empowering practice to be done in a quiet, meditative way. Find the holes in yourself, the places where the five A's have been unfulfilled. Think of all the times you have tried to fill these holes with someone or something else. Make a commitment to climb into these scary craters and sit in them on your own with no attempt to fill them. The only tools you bring in with you are the five A's. Simply stay in each of your deficiencies attentively, acceptantly, appreciatively, and affectionately, fully allowing it to be there without protest, shame, or blame. The five A's are the only true fulfillment of needs. By giving them to yourself, you are healing wounds you received because you didn't get them from others in the past. As you stay with your empty places again and again, you will gradually see them open into lively spaces. Our gaps are not covered or canceled, but exposed by the five A's. Alice, by herself, followed the white rabbit into a hole that led to the parts of herself that were confusing and scary. Ask yourself if your various partners were meant to be just such rabbits that kindly tried to show you the way into your deepest self. And now you are finally willing to enter. A soulmate, by the way, is a partner who is willing to take this journey with you, carrying the same tools. Witnessing the pain. Early or throughout life, your partner or you may have suffered abuse and or betrayals and hurts. Offer your partner the experience of mindful witnessing of the pain that still remains. Mindful witnessing means listening with complete attentiveness, acceptance, allowing, affection, and appreciation for what the other person reveals and the feelings behind the person's story. As a mindful witness, you do not give advice or try to fix anything, but simply take in what is said and felt in a respectful and encouraging way. Keep what is said completely confidential and do not talk about it unless the other person asks you to. One caution, do not try this practice if one of you feels unready to face pain, for the practice may bring up pain that has been repressed and controlled for years. Locating the pearl. Consider this commentary on the pearl as a metaphor for pain and its potential to be changed into something beautiful. Then write a poem in response. Exploring your memories of pearls and how they figure in your life, or answer the questions I've supplied below. First, the commentary on the pearl. In reaction to an irritation caused by a parasite or a grain of sand, the self-healing power of an oyster covers it with layers of aragonite. After several years, a pearl is created, composed of the same materials as the inner shell of the oyster. A pearl thus achieves its beauty and value from deep within its own protective shell. The unique luster of pearls depends on the refraction of light from their translucent layerings. The iridescence that some pearls emit is caused by the overlapping of many successive layers that disperse the light as it hits them. Unlike other gems, pearls are not cut or polished. They can easily decay, and their softness makes them vulnerable to acids and heat. Pearls like to be worn against human skin, which is the best way to maintain their luster. There are many layers of metaphor in this description. Journal your responses to these questions. What is the grit in you that awaits attention or has already been covered? Do you trust your inner resources to provide the layerings that will make the grit into a pearl? Notice the phrases in the description of the pearl: self-healing power, from deep within its own protective shell, their softness makes them vulnerable, against human skin to maintain their luster. How do they fit for you? Part 2, Struggles Along the Way. We begin with a quote from Aeschylus from the play Agamemnon. Zeus ordained that only in sorrow and in suffering do we find wisdom's way. It is by suffering that we gain understanding. Chapter 3, Choosing a Partner. Perhaps the best partners come to us when we neither seek nor avoid the possibility of finding someone. We simply live in accord with our deepest needs and wishes and notice people we meet. We trust the universe and its miraculous power of synchronicity to bring us just the person who is best for us. But even more important than finding a partner is taking care of our hearts in a dating game that can be a devastating enterprise of broken promises and disappointed expectations. Caring for ourselves while dating means not betraying our true nature in a desperate attempt to get someone to want us. We have to retain our boundaries intact if the process is not to end in self-abandonment and self-deprecation. We cannot allow anyone to take advantage of us or put us down for trying. Looking at ourselves from this perspective, we think, I want a partner, and I am taking care of myself as the first step. I remain the sentry over my vulnerable inner self during this process, which may be quite dangerous to my self-esteem. Yet we cannot be overcautious, for our sense of aliveness is directly proportional to how much we allow our longings to have their full career in our hearts. Longing is a source of motivation and thus of achievement. In a profound way, longing is our capacity to love. Our goal as healthy people is not to give up longing for a relationship, but to let it be fulfilled moderately by others and following a model of mutuality rather than neediness. After all, relationships are not meant to fulfill us completely, but to provide us with ever-changing and ever-evolving resources as we move through life. This happens when our feelings are welcomed and supported with the 5 A's, and when more and more of our shadow side is perceived by the other, who meets it with the 5 A's as well. In early life, we may have had to hide our deepest selves in order to maintain the bond with our parents. We may have become used to paying that price, and so we went on paying it in relationships too. We stayed where we had to hide. That changes as we become healthy adults. We still have needs, but they no longer have us. When we tolerate not having our needs met fully, fear turns to vulnerability and a more generous love awakens in us. A healthy person looks and longs for an open, caring, daring partner capable of attuning to and holding his feelings. This grants unprecedented permission to the frightened child within to release old hurts and trust new ties. Am I cut out for close, intimate relationships? An adult commitment is a thoroughly truthful enterprise of ongoing love. It entails an unremitting willingness to keep agreements and handle obstacles by addressing, processing, and resolving conflicts. Happiness and mutual respect result. True love cannot be fooled, nor does it attempt to fool others. As mature adults, we can no longer be charmed by looks or sweet talk. All that matters is enduring mutual commitment. Some people confuse attachment with love. We may feel attached to someone and we imagine we love him. Someone may be attached to us and we imagine he loves us. But mindful love is bonding by commitment, not by attachment, not by clinging. Being attached will immobilize us. Love, on the other hand, helps us achieve a progressively effective and joyous evolution. We can also mistake dependency for connection. Insecure people may try to create a connection with us by fostering dependency through the offer of riches, humor, flattery, indebtedness. The five A's, especially allowing, offer the reliable alternative path. Of course, not everyone is cut out for a fully committed relationship. Someone can work diligently on all the practices in this book and still not be able to fulfill the needs of another adult in an intimate bond. He may not be relationship-oriented, or he may simply have no interest in doing the work a relationship requires. Some people are more comfortable with and only psychologically calibrated for light relationships or friendships. Such people are driven not by fear of intimacy, but by truthful recognition that intimacy is not for them. There is no shame in not wanting a relationship. A healthy person is not one in a relationship, but one in his own skin. So many of us married out of social convention rather than out of a choice that reflected our deepest inclinations, readiness, and personality. People who have it in them only to be friends, never spouses, want the rhythms of distance and closeness that friendship provides. They prefer absence alternating with presence rather than continued presence. This is a legitimate option, but social pressures, once internalized, may push such a person into marriage, and the result is two unhappy people and perhaps unhappy children. In the conventional view, living together is considered the logical goal of relating and an indicator of success. But the reality is that some people do not do well in mutual living situations, and they are better off in separate quarters, even when the relationship becomes more intimate. Neighbors might have a better chance at stress-free relating than live-in partners. It is up to both partners to make the uniquely appropriate plan that fits for them. A primary goal in a relationship is to make sure it has the best chance of surviving, and that may not happen under one roof. Marriage and family are a special vocation, not meant for everyone. It is an individual, not a collective choice. It is for those who will enjoy a commitment to lifelong working through, working on, working within a context of family. It is equally legitimate to choose a celibate life, a gay life, serial relationships with children or marriage, or any variation of these. The issue for a healthy adult is not which choice she makes, but whether it reflects her true desires and is carried out with integrity. This book, including the practices, is meant for straight and gay readers, marrieds and unmarrieds, friends, companions, anyone trying to love someone and be happy. Qualified candidates. Once we make our relationship choices in an adult way, a prospective partner who is unavailable, non-reciprocal, or not open to processing feelings and issues becomes, by those very facts, unappealing. Once we love ourselves, people no longer look good to us unless they are good for us. A person is a candidate for a relationship when he is able and willing to give and receive love, to handle feelings, to make a commitment, and to keep agreements. He can show the five A's in ways that are pleasing, satisfying, and non-invasive. He can forgive and let go of his ego long enough to work problems out amicably and fairly most of the time. He follows a reconciliation, not a retaliation, model in his interactions. He loves you for yourself, not as the latest woman to fill the slot in his life marked female. A suitable candidate will probably meet the following additional criteria. Lives reasonably close by. Has no distracting ties that make true commitment impossible, such as another relationship in progress, an old relationship unfinished, a divorce pending, a parent to be cared for or consulted. Children do not represent an obstacle unless they require or are given so much attention that the prospective partner is tied codependently to their needs and has no life of his own. Has no active addictions. Has no overpowering political or religious obsessions. Wants children if you do or does not want them if you do not. Has the sexual capacity, accessibility, and interest to satisfy you or can work on it within the relationship. Has no disability with respect to money. Example, can't earn, can't spend, can't share, can't save, can't lend, can't contribute, can't receive. Is your friend, not just your sex partner. Loves your company and is compatible. Shares interests with you. Is on a fairly close intellectual par, so you do not have to play down your vocabulary or acumen. Is not looking for the ideal woman or man. To need the ideal woman or man is not to want a real woman or man, the only kind out there. Does not appear to you to be ideal. You are not so infatuated that you cannot see his shadow side. A qualified candidate has done at least half the work it takes to be healthy in life and relationships. He or she satisfies the ruthless criterion that applies to all significant choices, that a relationship with him or her reflects and fulfills your deepest needs, values, and wishes. He or she can and loves to focus on you in an engaged, lasting way. How do I know this is happening enough? I can remember the last time it happened. And finally, he or she meets with the welcoming approval of your personal trio, your head, your heart, and your gut. Do these criteria fit your prospective or current partner? What are we up to? I begin with a quote by Anais Nin. Every day, the real caress replaces the ghostly lover. It is now clear to us that completed transactions from childhood settle into a state of rest in our psyches. By contrast, unmet needs and incomplete transactions, like unfulfilled dreams and wishes, clamor for completion all our lives, hovering over most of our relationships. Thus, we have to learn how to finish our old emotional business on our own when a partner will not finish it for or even with us. What are we up to when we look for a relationship? Our apparent agenda may be the opposite of our real agenda. We have a conscious agenda when what we say we want matches what we set out to do. For instance, we say we want a relationship and we mean it, so we are willing to make a commitment. A secret agenda, on the other hand, is usually one that's unknown to us. We have a secret agenda when we actually want the opposite of what we say we want. For instance, a woman who says she's looking for a partner becomes especially interested only when a man seems unattainable. Once he becomes attainable, however, she loses interest quickly. The clue to a person's true agenda is always in how the transaction ends. In this example, the woman's real agenda, genuinely unknown to her, is not to find a partner, but to conquer one and then no longer to have to want him. Here is another example. Piers presents himself as looking for an intimate partnership. His secret agenda, however, is not to find adult intimacy, because that scares him deeply. His fantasy of intimacy is to be held and cared about physically, but he is not so concerned about what his partner might get from him. Interestingly, when Piers locates someone, either she is just right and not available, or she is available but not quite right. This makes him seek further. He is disappointed, but fully convinced he is looking for intimacy and not finding it. In reality, though, he is spinning his wheels. Piers's real agenda is secret even to Piers. He may be terrified of closeness. He may feel compelled to repeat an original and now habitual disappointment with women. His actions and frustrations show him where his work is. But will he ever do it? How many women will be blamed? How many relationships will go sour before he sees? If he doesn't acknowledge his pattern, Piers will never know his own agenda, how it disables him from intimacy, how it relates to issues in his early life, or how to do the work that will free him from self-defeat. Peter, unlike Piers, has a sincere, open agenda and no secret agenda. His fantasy is to hold and be held by someone who does not have to be perfect. When he locates a prospective partner, he asks himself, is she available? Does she approximate what I want? And are we warming up to one another? If she is unavailable, no matter how attractive, he doesn't waste his energy, but passes her over. Peter bases his level of responsiveness on his intuitive powers of assessment. In a partnership, when beset with obstacles and conflicts, he works through them with his partner the way an adult in a committed relationship does. Piers and Peter illustrate the distinction between willing and wishing. To will is truly to want something. To choose both the goal and the means to the goal. This means accepting the work and the risks involved in seeing something through. To wish is only to be enamored of the goal. Piers wishes for intimacy, but Peter really wants it. Both Piers and Peter may marry. Peter chooses a partner wisely. Marriage truly suits him. Piers eventually marries someone with whom he can continue the game of hide and seek. He marries because that is what one does, making the big decision before he really knows himself. Finding a match is usually easy for people like Piers because more people are drawn to apparent openness and availability than are drawn to authentic openness. Piers, then, will have many more candidates to choose from than Peter will. This is not because the candidates are foolish, but because they are afraid. After all, the real thing can make demands and hurt, and it is certainly unfamiliar. There is one final quality to assess in determining availability. A writer needs to know whether his computer is equipped with enough random access memory, RAM, to hold the volume of material he has to work with. Likewise, processing conflicts in relationships can take a great deal of emotional energy, so we need to know whether we have enough random emotional energy to work on all kinds of conflicts that arise in a relationship, and whether our partner does also. For example, if your prospective partner has deep issues of sexual confusion and inhibition because of incest in her past, this will require serious long-term work on both your parts if you want a happy sex life. Are you willing to do this work? Is your partner? If not, you are undertaking a project you cannot finish. Working in personal therapy or in a support group may help, but if you cannot carry the freight of your personal issues, no amount of love will create enough wind for your voyage. The commitment to work through problems as they arise is the only sign that we truly want full intimacy. Only that commitment makes a difference, not good looks, empty words, not what we seek, not even what we find. An adult knows his limits, addresses them, and expands them wherever possible. That is the equivalent of candidacy for an intensely real relationship. Even if we did not find the 5 A's in childhood, we can find them and give them in a truly intimate adult relationship that allows a no-holds-barred exchange of feelings. Not all healthy relationships offer this, of course. Some partners want only a light, undemanding companionship, while others want to share their deepest feelings and experiences, both past and present. Both styles are acceptable, but it is important for us to know whether a prospective partner is seeking the same style of relationship that we are. Conflict happens in both kinds of relationships, but in the former, it is dealt with lightly and passed over, as are the gruesome dramas of one's past. In the latter, however, conflict is addressed with ruthless directness and processed with what might be unpleasant, messy feelings. We grew up seeing both models in the movies of the 1940s and 50s. The light and lovely companionship of Cary Grant and Myrna Loy in Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House was quite different from the blood-curdling storm and truth intimacy of Marlon Brando and Kim Hunter in A Streetcar Named Desire. If we want Mr. Blandings' dream house, it would be best not to board the Desire streetcar. One way to know whether someone is open to working on a relationship with you is to give him this book. Notice whether he even reads it, reacts negatively or positively, and most of all, wants to discuss it and even practice its suggestions with you. Reading and working on this book together is also useful if you are concerned that your partner has stopped growing. Full disclosure. Beginning with a quote by David O. Selznick, his proposal note to his future wife, Irene Mayer. I snore loudly, drink exuberantly, work excessively, and my future is drawing to a close, but I am tall and Jewish, and I do love you. The first requirement for trust and commitment is telling the truth. We sometimes do not share our feelings and reactions with a partner because we sense that she cannot receive the truth from us. Only when the relationship is over do we let go fully with all we have stored up and always wanted to say or show. Then we find out how inhibiting the relationship was for us and how afraid we were of the full truth, ours and others. We feared saying what the other was afraid to hear. We were missing out on the 5 A's, but putting up with the deficit to maintain the bond and avoid winding up alone. But we can say and hear anything when we trust the loving intent and loyalty of another person. In the holding environment of intimacy, we can allow the truth to emerge without fear, shame, or embarrassment. Such trust flourishes when partners are committed to working on themselves. The personal information we exchange then is not scary, but becomes grist for the mill. Thus, commitment to personal work is the equivalent of commitment to intimacy. And since self-disclosure entails letting go of ego, a spiritual practice figures in too. In the meantime, we may want to make a disclosure of some kind so a new partner may know what she's getting into, but only if we are open to the partner's feedback, because it will certainly lead to that. The paradox is that self-disclosure leads to more self-knowledge. This is the letter of self-disclosure one partner might write to another. Our relationship seems to be getting serious now, and I'm happy about that. In the interest of keeping everything clear between us, I would like to share some things about myself. I'll begin with the qualities that are less appealing and then go on to others that may be more encouraging. I want so much to love and be loved, but I have to admit that my fears make me fight it tooth and nail once it gets close to happening. I can only be loved by someone flexible enough to allow for such inadequacy. In fact, I can't be depended on for perfection in any area. If you can only love someone who meets your specifications as a perfect mate, you won't want me. If you have a rigid definition of love, I won't fulfill it. I don't have a history of getting it right. Most likely, I will not come through for you as often as you would like. I am often combative, especially when I notice that intimacy is beginning to happen. I may not always listen or even try to understand. I may not always be there for you when you need me. I may not accept you as you are. I may seduce you with my looks, my charms, my words, or sex, and then I may not deliver. I look self-sufficient, but that is a facade, Underneath, I am needy, scared, bereft, and lonely. I may lie or hide my true feelings. I may run from yours. I may try to get you to do things for me or give me things. Those are my ways of getting you to prove that you love me. I may want a relationship for selfish reasons, to have you there for me when and as I want you. I may not be available for a true exchange. I may not welcome someone who comes with personal requirements. I will have to learn how to honor them, and it may take time. Do you have time? I have noticed that with my distressed childhood background, the hill of relating slants quite steeply. I may be seeing one or both of my parents in you and may try to get you to give me what they gave me or could not give me. I may try to control you. You will have to be on your toes to catch me in my many slippery ways of manipulating you. And if you do catch me and confront me about it, I may be so scared that I lash out at you for standing up to me. I may not be able to handle your freedom or your choices. I am jealous and even paranoid at times. It may be intolerable to me that you have close friends. If you require someone who won't ever make you cry, I'm the wrong one for you. I could hurt you. You can only love me as I am, not as you need me to be. I'll disappoint you again and again, as long as you expect me to meet your criteria. You can only love me unconditionally and with no guarantees that it will pay off to do so. On the other hand, I can also offer you some valuable things, more valuable than what money can buy, which I may not always have much of. In each of these, I acknowledge my limitations and my commitment to work on them. I know who I am, and I'm not ashamed to admit what I know. At the same time, I know it's in me to lie or hide to protect myself. I am working on myself. I'm looking for ways to love more authentically. I do this by trial and error, by asking and doing, by falling and rising, by busting myself and letting myself be busted, by being and becoming. I want to love you the way you want to be loved, and I welcome your telling me how. I'm always scanning my behavior to see exactly how I am controlling and demanding. And though I often don't notice, I welcome your saying ouch. When I see how I offend, I do make amends. I may hurt you, but it will never be with malice, only through oversight, or because my scared ego is strangling my wish to be kind. I'm trying to feel safer with vulnerability, with letting the truth come out, no matter how threatened it makes me feel. This is a work in progress, nowhere near completion. Perhaps you can even hear me opening right now in this honest and embarrassing presentation of myself. I am not trying to look good. I want to be good enough to love honestly. I want to be transparent so that you can help me know where my work is. Go by my performance, not by my promises. Review my history by calling my former partners, spouses, lovers, friends. Then look for signs of change. Decide with your eyes wide open. Make an informed consent. I won't disappoint you if you know me as a fallible human being with love to give and not much practice in giving it consistently, but with a commitment to keep practicing. I can only be loved with all my faults, my efforts to amend them, and my failures to amend them. Accept me as I am, and love can happen between us. I can only be loved by someone who loves me for my frailty, the extent of which will keep surprising both of us. I can only be loved by someone who loves me with my arrogant ego, with my shadow, and with all the scar tissue of my childhood. I can only be loved by someone who, like me, has let go of the belief that anyone can be perfect for anyone else. It will take guts and perseverance to be with me. You will need arms that can hold a frightened inner child without losing respect for the outer adult. You will need eyes that can glimpse the terror that sometimes hides behind a mask of rage. You will need a heart that can bear pain and loss without losing trust in the love that is trying to find you. I have lived too long in the past of not enough and the future of not yet. I feel readier than ever for love in the here and now. I've fallen in love before, usually with an image of an ideal or a projection of a fantasy. But this time, I'd like to rise and stand in love with the real you. This time, I will be working for a grade report of 5 A's. Perhaps this is how we will not miss you and I, love's many splendored thing. I close my letter with these favorite words from Twelfth Night. I have unclasped to thee the book, even of my secret soul. P.S. Don't be fooled by my eloquence. Sometimes I can be pretty rude. And we end this section with a quote from Carl Rogers. I have come to recognize that being trustworthy does not demand that I be rigidly consistent, but that I be dependably real. Can I be expressive enough as a person that what I am will be communicated unambiguously? Sexualizing our needs. Beginning with lines from William Butler Yeats. Players and painted stage took all my love, and not those things that they were emblems of. Now that my ladder's gone, I must lie down where all the ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. St. Thomas Aquinas was once asked if Adam and Eve had sex before their fall in the Garden of Eden, before ego became the driving force of human choice. He answered, yes, the intensity of pleasure is not excluded from the state of innocence. Only the fever of lust and restlessness are. Perhaps from this thought we begin to see what sex with the 5 A's might look like. The primary motivation for each of us is to bring pleasure to the other. There is no goal. We allow for shifting levels of arousal throughout lovemaking. We continually check in with one another through eye contact, smiles, hugs, words. There is actually a physical basis for a connection between nurturance and sexual fulfillment. The pituitary hormone oxytocin is released in the cuddly moments following sex. Oxytocin works on the mammary glands to stimulate the release of milk in nursing mothers. It seems that nature intended sex to be connected with nurture and tenderness, as if in love we breastfeed one another's hearts. Needy sex carries that delectable charge, the thrill of involuntary sensation and irresistible force, the anticipation of ecstasy, the lust with a must. Exploits our unconscious habits and longings. It is sensation, physical autonomic reaction, not feeling, physical emotional intelligent response. Sex based on charge is stimulating and sensational, but does not include the authentic depth of feeling that is requisite to intimacy. We sometimes seek a sexual relationship not to share an adult passion, but because we believe that a sexual response from another person fulfills our unmet emotional needs or even grants us a sense of security. We may feel we are simply looking for sex when we are actually seeking to be personally received and confirmed with the 5 A's. When we sexualize our needs in this way, we are recruiting our genitals for tasks that they are not designed to fulfill. Sex is a trickster. It can feel good no matter how unfulfilling or troubled the relationship. Sex can even survive unscathed in the midst of abuse or anger. This is not a skill, but may signal a severe disability and confusion in self-nurturance. As the Greek playwright Euripides sardonically writes in Medea, if your life at night is good, you think you have everything. Because sex leads to bonding, problems with sex in a relationship may increase with the fear of intimacy. Anyone who fears commitment will run when he senses the growing bond that forms automatically as sex matures. The running can take the form of a breakup or an uproar, anger, infidelity, addictive behavior. A relationship based solely on sex, rather than on a fulfilling friendship that includes sex, can turn to ashes in the years to come. Such relationships can endure 30 years of marriage, but they will be stale, non-nurturant, and sorely regretted. An adult makes the transition from attraction as charge to attraction as choice. He does not repress the charge, the chemical reaction, he enjoys it, but he does not get hooked into the melodrama because of it. The duller the inner life of people in relationships, the more sophisticated their search for thrills, for sensation without feeling. Some people have only had sex as sensation. Perhaps this is the definition of superficiality. As we become healthier and more adult, we no longer seek sex for joy, but share sex because of joy. When there is happiness in our inner world, we give up the frantic search for happiness in sex. In fact, we give up desire for anything outside ourselves because there is nothing outside ourselves anymore, only an ever-expanding oneness. We allow sex to be ordinary, taking up no more room in our life than our genitals do on our body. Such longings. We may feel our life is meaningless if we are not in love with someone or not in a sexual relationship. If so, we discredit ourselves and miss out on all the rest of what our life is about. When we feel the absolute need for a one-to-one love, we are really meeting up with a strong need for personal work on ourselves. Our longing for that special someone, the be-all and end-all of our lives, also distracts us from our spiritual practice of compassion, the broader love that is our real focus and destiny as enlightened beings. It is not that erotic and intimate love are not worthy human pursuits, only that they seem to work better if we approach them with mindfulness. We relate to our desire for love mindfully by feeling it fully, witnessing how it changes and where it leads us, and accepting that it may or may not be fulfilled soon. The painful alternative is to become possessed by our desire, so obsessed by it that perspective deserts us and we see only the inside of our own head, like a prisoner who sees only the walls of his cell and takes them for a four-cornered world. Then we are unconscious of how desire works or how it can serve as a means to our psychological and spiritual maturity. To reveal our longings to a partner is to trust that he will understand, hold, and mirror them as perfectly legitimate. That validation is what we long for even more than fulfillment. Sometimes our longing is so strong and the partner of our dreams is so long in coming that we settle for sex as if it were love. Fortunately, copious touch with scant love will cloy quickly. Such cloying may be a gift that directs our psyche back to the path of wholeness. The healthier we become, the more we want only the combination of love and holding, not the ruptured abridgments that come from strangers who offer one-night stands or sex for money. The more respect we have for our own sexuality, the fewer chances we take that will stunt or blunt it. When we save sex for love's purposes, and for as long as love takes to get to us, it serves us and others as a means to more love. Practices. Comparing wishes. Do you have or want a face-to-face lifestyle or a side-by-side lifestyle? If you hold your hand so that one palm faces the other, and then hold your hand side by side so that both palms face outward and your thumbs almost touch, you see an illustration of the two styles. If both partners agree on either style, life can proceed smoothly. If one partner wants one configuration and the other wants the opposite, conflict arises. Keep one palm facing inward and the other outward, and you will see the problem. Then hold your hands back to back with your palms on the outside. Now you see an example of distance. Which fits your situation? If your relationship is palms outward, are the hands still touching at the thumbs, or have they drifted apart so that now you and your partner do less and less together? This happens frequently in relationships in which the accent is on individual freedom. Compromises in the course of a relationship are healthy. When the compromises favor autonomy, distance may grow. When the compromises favor bonding, intimacy grows. Where do you stand? Meditate on these questions and bring your answers to your partner in a way that implies no censure. Make a plan to align yourselves more satisfactorily. If you cannot do this, consider asking a therapist for assistance. Adults design a lifestyle in keeping with the percentages of their needs for alone time and for togetherness. For example, if each of you want to spend 50% of your time together, that logically necessitates outside interests. Ask these questions in your journal. Do I have interests and hobbies in place? Do I resent my partner for having an outside focus? Has all this been figured into the equation of our relationship? Can you answer yes to these questions? Can your partner focus on you and respond to your needs? Is your partner working on herself? Does your partner love you sanely rather than need you desperately? Does she keep agreements? Does she collaborate with you to handle obstacles together? Are you happy together more than half the time? Can she handle your strength, your feelings, and your freedom? Do you feel loved in that special way that is unique to you? And do you feel it bodily? Can you share with this person what troubles, excites, or delights you? If you can see the difference between a good partner and not so good one, but cannot let go of someone who is wrong for you, if you make the same mistakes with one partner after another, or if you are the victim of or volunteer for one predator after another, ask a friend to become your relationship sponsor. We all need consultants, advocates, and sponsors throughout life. A relationship sponsor bird dogs your relationships and has to pass on every prospective partner since you have admitted that your powers of assessment are weak. This unusual suggestion may make more sense than at first it might appear. Using the even though technique. Answer yes or no aloud. Would you eat strawberries you knew to be deliciously sweet if you were seriously allergic to them? Would you eat mushrooms that looked delicious if you knew that they might be poisonous? Would you attempt to read a book you knew to be interesting if it was written in a language you did not understand? Would you stay in a relationship with someone you loved if you were unhappy? Would you blame the strawberries for your allergic reaction? The mushrooms for poisoning you? Or the book for confusing you? Do you blame your partner for your unhappiness? Let's look closely at the questions. Each object offers advantages, but with one serious drawback. Adults can let go of the good things if the one bad thing outweighs them. Even though I'm crazy about you, and you're a great provider, I can't stay with you while you are such a liar and refuse help. Are you seduced by the advantages of a partner while you disregard, deny, or lie to yourself about his disadvantages? Or do you act according to the full truth, even though you wished it were not so? How much self-nurturance and tolerance for grief it takes to disregard that even though. Here are the words of an adult. Even though you please me sexually, even though we have been together for so long, even though I don't know whether I will ever find someone else, I have to let you go because you do not meet me at my soul adult level. Here are the words of a codependent. Because you please me sexually, because we have been together for so long, because I don't know whether I will ever find someone else, I can't let you go even though you do not meet me at my soul, S-O-U-L, adult level. Come up with your own even though statement. Apply it to having nothing in common, for instance. We may love someone and know she loves us, but if she is not a peer or even interested in the things we are passionate about, an unremitting loneliness will eventually strangle the relationship. Would you dare to say, neither in soulful friendship nor in authentic intimacy do you offer what I need? So even though you meet many of my needs, I have to give you up because you do not provide the essential ones. Vowing and disavowing. Ask yourself, am I making a vow of commitment to my partner while disavowing my essential partnership with my own inner self? Ask these questions of one another. Can we find ways to work separately on the inner discoveries we both need to make before we can fulfill one another's needs adequately? Can you grant me that space? Can I allow you that space? Can I trust that you will still be there for me when I come back, intact and ready to be in touch? Will I be there for you also? Or will our urgent childhood needs or our desire for drama be so intense that we will vitiate or scuttle this whole soulful venture? Are we genuinely committed to doing the work it will take to safeguard our relationship? Taking a sexual inventory. In your journal, write an inventory of your own sexual behaviors over your lifetime and ask yourself if you are satisfied with them. How did or do you find or give mirroring in sex? In your present relationship, do you look for and offer fusion without intrusion, closeness without possessiveness? Have you done so in the past? Do you sexualize your need for love? Are you looking for the one who can take you to the outermost limits of pleasure, or the one with whom you can mutually touch an innermost core? Opening windows. Draw a picture of a square room seen from above, showing a picture window in each wall. Mark the windows with the directions of the compass, north, south, east, west. Under the word east, where dawn appears, write three things in your life that are now arising. Under the word west, where the sun sets, write three things in your life that are now ending. Under the word north, write three things in your life that stabilize and guide you, as does the North Star. Under the word south, write three things in your life that evoke your spontaneity and creativity, the kind of opening up that can happen when facing a warm southern exposure. You have drawn a picture of a healthy human mind. It is a clear space that opens in all possible directions, without obstruction, distraction, or fear. Picture yourself sitting mindfully in the center of the room, alternately turning toward each of the four windows. The challenge is to face your east with a willingness to take hold of what is beginning, to face your west with a willingness to let go of what is ending, to face north by staying with your spiritual practice, and to face south with an ever-enthusiastic creativity in the reinvention of your life. Now ask yourself if your psyche is a room with openings like this. How do you look out of each of the windows? Who helps open your windows? Who is trying to close them? Who says, whoa, when you say, we? And who says, go? Journal your responses and share what you discover with your partner and with whatever guardian angel or bodhisattva stands beckoning outside each window. Chapter 4, Romance, the First Phase of Relationship. Actually, in the chapter we just finished, we realized that investigation is the true first phase of an adult relationship, But romance is certainly the exciting part of the whole experience. It is comforting to know that relationships go through stages. If they always stayed the same, wouldn't all of us be bored and boring? The phases of human relating involve passages of origin, change, loss, grief, renewal.